right, so let's review what we've done so far, finish up 11, and then today we're going to do chapter 12. Okay. Deformations. Okay, if you apply a stress, a force per area, okay, your system will deform. Okay, it will undergo a strain. The form of the strain is different considering the different situations. There are two types. There's linear deformation, in which case you have typically something that is long compared to its cross-sectional area, or you're applying a force such as to either compress it or stretch it. So you can have a mountain climber hanging on a cable, for example, and you'd like to know, okay, how much the cable stretches as the climber's on it. Or, you know, you could have, as I said yesterday, a statue sitting on a column, right? And that column supports all that weight, right? The weight is the force pushing down on it, and you want to know how that column will shrink due to that, because of that force. Shear. Shear is what happens when you've got something like this. I push up against these papers in one direction, right? And the friction on the bottom pushes in the other, so it causes it to deform in this way. It skews it. Okay, and then that deformation, by applying a force per area, is given by delta x is how much x is changed in that direction, and L0 is essentially the height, which we assume is changing. Okay, and then we have a solid object that if you apply pressure basically all around it, that object, okay, it could compress, all right, that's a bulk object, okay, and what changes in that case is the volume, and so in all of these there is some fractional change. You'll notice that the units cancel here, right, meters over meters, meters over meters, meters cubed over meters cubed, so you end up with moduli. You have the Young's modulus, you have the shear modulus, the bulk modulus, all of these typically have units corresponding to newtons per meter squared, so that you get newtons per meter squared out.
What were the first two introduced as pressure? Like in the book and in our lab, you didn't really introduce those two as...
Because when we think of pressure, we're thinking pressure on bulk volume, on volumes.
So it has to be typically.
Yeah, that's typically the way that it is. But most of our pressure concerns will right now be concerned with fluids. Then we moved on to fluids. There are a few characteristics of fluids that we introduced. First off, a fluid has a density. This is a mass density per volume, a mass volume density. This is so many kilograms per cubic meter. We need to get down that length has unit, length has units of length, right? Area is length squared. Volume is length cubed. So you need to have meters cubed. One constant that comes up quite a bit in applications is water. The density of water is 1,000. Ideally, obviously, there is water which has other stuff in it, pollutants, salt, right? Salt water is a little different than 1,000. But that's, you know, typically for pure water, right? We'd have to worry about at what conditions, as we'll find out later this week, that we really should pay attention to temperature and other types of things as far as that's concerned. But most of our applications will take water to be 1,000. Pressure is defined as force per area. And then we looked at pressure at a depth, which typically, as you go underwater, right, the reason that there's more pressure the deeper you go is because you're supporting on your shoulders all of that weight. In fact, standing right here or sitting here, we're also supporting a lot of weight on us, the weight of the atmosphere. Right? Even though the atmosphere is not quite as dense, okay, except on maybe days like today when it's going to be fairly humid and feels a lot heavier. Okay, the idea is you've got miles of air that you support every day. Walk around. Alright? And so that has a certain force of the weight pushing down on your cross section. Okay? And so there's a pressure, right? And that pressure at sea level is 1 atmosphere. That's why we have the term atmosphere, which is 14.7 pounds per square inch, which comes up once in a while in problems. But for the most part, pressure will be in pascals. You need to know how to go back and forth between pascals, which is designated PA, and atmospheres. 1 atmosphere is roughly 10 to the fifth pascals. Okay. And pressure to depth is simply given by this formula. The difference in these two pressures is rho gh. If I have a pressure and I subtract 1 atmosphere from it, it's called the gauge pressure. Okay, so you'll see there's a section I haven't talked about too much and won't be talking too much about instruments for measuring pressure, such as manometers and barometers and whatnot. Okay, but every once in a while somebody will introduce the concept of gauge pressure. So, for example, a tire gauge would measure gauge pressure. Basically, it's not the absolute pressure, but it's the pressure minus 1 atmosphere. How far away are we from 1 atmosphere? Okay, Archimedes' principle. Put an object in a fluid, it will feel a force, a buoyant force. The buoyant force, according to Archimedes' principle, is equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. That's all it is. That's what Archimedes' principle is. The buoyant force is the weight of the displaced fluid. Of course, you have to be able to use it. Right? It becomes another force that you have to consider, just like we've done in the past. We'll do one more example of that before moving on. And then one more principle will finish up this chapter, and that's Pascal's principle, which actually was introduced earlier in the chapter before Archimedes, but being that we were doing the lab yesterday, I wanted to get Archimedes out in the open. So we got to use Archimedes' principle yesterday. So let's look at this particular example. Let's imagine we have an iceberg sitting in, for now, pure water. Okay, as I have indicated here, this could also be an ice cube in a drink. Though, as some of you may be sitting there wondering, you're thinking, let's see, it could be Pepsi or Diet Pepsi, considering that yesterday we had seen that a Diet Pepsi can will float in water, whereas a regular Pepsi doesn't. Okay. But, anyway, how much of the iceberg is below water? Okay, we got 80%. Anyone else? There's got to be something high because of the way I drew it. Okay, the object is to figure out what fraction of the iceberg is underwater. Okay, so how much of the iceberg see if we compose this in a quantitative way. Essentially, the iceberg has a particular volume, right? The part of the iceberg that's underwater has a volume, and I want to look at the ratio of those two. Okay. So let's see. How much of the iceberg is underwater? Well, the amount of the iceberg that's underwater is equal to the amount of fluid that was displaced. So the volume underwater is the volume of the fluid, and we'll write V sub I for V of the iceberg. All right, so that gives me the fraction of the iceberg that's underwater. So that's what I'd like to find. What do I have at my disposal? Well, Archimedes' principle. Okay. What does Archimedes' principle tell me? I put the iceberg in the water. There is a buoyant force acting on the iceberg, helping to push it up, and the weight of the iceberg. Again, most of these problems are like this. I did a problem with a boat yesterday. Pretty much the same picture, except I had a boat there instead of an iceberg. Okay? It doesn't matter what we do afterwards. So we have that the buoyant force should be equal to the weight if this is just going to be sitting there, not going further down or starting to go back further up, right? Okay, let's see. The buoyant force is equal to the weight of the iceberg. What's the buoyant force? Well, it's just the density of the fluid times the volume of the fluid times little g. So let's put that in. That density of the fluid times the volume of the fluid times little g's. And what about the weight of the iceberg?
Mg.
Well, it's mg's. But I'm going to be, like I did in the lab yesterday, I can write down the mass of the iceberg in terms of its density, right? So the weight is mg, but m for the iceberg is the density of ice times the volume of the iceberg times g. Notice that we're beginning to get vf and vi together. Okay. Since I want VF over VI, I could do that by leaving VF on the left side, bringing VI to the left, and everything else to the other side. All right, I can get my ratio. The G's are going to go out. So we get what? VF over VI is equal to what? Rho I over rho F. All right, let's, instead of minding our P's and Q's, let's mind our P's and rho's. Okay? Notice in this equation, we've got P and rho in the same equation. All right, so let's see. That gives me the fraction I wanted, right? This gives me the fraction of the iceberg that's underwater in terms of the density of ice and the density of the fluid. What is the density of ice? Well, we have to look it up in the table. All right, if you look in your book in the table, you get something like 917 kilograms per cubic meter. All right, why don't I put that in there? What's the density of water?
1,000
kilograms per cubic meter. So 917 over 1,000 is?
0.917.
What?
0.917.
No units, right? Notice the units go out, and that's about 92%. So 92% is underwater. Actually, the figure should be more like 90%. Why should it be more like 90%?
Because salt water is.
Because it's salt water, okay. Do we know anything about salt water?
Less dense.
More dense. How much more dense?
Depends on the amount of salt.
You look it up. You take a trip up to Alaska and make a density measurement, right? You can look it up, and then you'll find out that the density here is in your book. Again, when you need to know these things, very often you'll find them in your book, right? So, first table in chapter 11. Let's see what they have here. They don't have it. We've got water at 4 degrees C. This book doesn't have it. I think it's more like 1,200 or something along that line. Okay, previous edition that we used didn't have it in here. It may be in a homework problem. All right, so anyway, using salt water, it's a little less dense. Of course, you know, now you can think about me when you're drinking your sodas with ice in them. Looking at, you know, give some big ice cubes. All right. What else? All right, Pascal's principle is the last topic. Pascal's principle is relatively simple. The idea of Pascal's principle is that if I have a fluid in an enclosed container, and I apply pressure, that pressure is distributed throughout the fluid and the walls of the container. So, an applied pressure to an enclosed fluid is transmitted throughout the fluid. And Now let me do the following. This is a typical type of problem. Okay, I'm going to have an opening in my container for which I apply a particular force per area. So let's say that I have an area, we'll call that A1, and then I have some kind of a container, and then at the other end I have another opening with an area A2. We'll assume that this is fluid that's contained within here. We apply a force per area, that's a pressure, right? So that's a pressure that's being applied. And the claim is, from Pascal's principle, that that pressure that's being applied here is transmitted throughout. That means I'll feel the pressure at this side as well. So we're going to feel a pressure due to my input pressure at this side on this end. And the pressures will be the same. So let me call that force 1 at this first side, and on the other side, I'll call that F2. And Pascal's principle essentially says that the pressure at each of these locations is the same. So what does that mean? What's the pressure? Force per area. So F1 over A1 is the pressure on the left side. F2 over A2 is the pressure on the right side. And Pascal's principle tells us those are equal. Okay? Do we know of any systems like this physically? Hydraulics. Okay, plenty of hydraulic systems. Okay, this is similar to what they do in a garage, right? You've got a little hole over here with a little handle on it, and the guy's standing there with one finger maybe. More, but he pushes down a little on this end, applies a small force, and somehow miraculously lifts a car. All right, we know it takes a lot more effort if you try to do it directly, right? So basically, that's big hydraulic system. Of course, there's smaller hydraulic systems that do the same kinds of things. So we typically think of this side as the input force applied to that area, and on this side we have the output. Often you'll also run into terms such as pistons, all right, where one has a piston that they push down here and it pushes up. Okay, so we have an input force and an output force. Let's look at a simple example. Let F1 be 100 newtons worth of force. Let's say A1. Is, I don't know, say 0.1 square meters. Let A2 be a little larger. Let's say A2 is, well, that's probably good. Let's just make it 1 square meter is pretty big, isn't it? Okay, let's think about 1 square meter. That's one, think of a rectangle. Actually a square. This is 1 meter by 1 meter. So that 1 meter by 1 meter region, 1 square meter. So that's relatively decent size area. Question is, with this input force on my system, what's the output force? Okay, so we just come through and solve this. So F2 is equal to what? Bringing the A2 over, it's F1 A2 over A1. So we just multiply the input force by the ratio of the areas. A2 is 1 divided by 0.1, which is 1 over 0.1. 1 over 1/10. It's 10. So 10 times 100. Pretty much that's all Pascal's principle is. Okay. So we can summarize that very simply. All right,
so what we see on the board from this point on is chapter 11. Okay, we're not doing, as I said, anything on fluid dynamics or fluids in motion. Okay, though that is interesting, and I would encourage you to read that before you sell your book back. All right, so next several days, most of the rest of the week, we are going to spend talking about another subject. All right, so far we've looked at fluids. We're going to next talk about thermal physics, and then after that we'll say a few things about waves. That's where we're headed by the end of the semester. Okay, and then next semester you'll see some other topics. Okay, we're not done with physics, as you know from some of your readings. And so next semester you'll get to see things like electricity, magnetism, light, optics, okay, those kinds of things. Okay. All right, so let me begin talking about chapter 12. Okay, chapter 12 covers some material that you may have seen, but I would encourage you to study it anyway so that you don't just assume that you remembered it in some cases. Okay, we're going to start talking about temperature. And heat energy. Okay, temperature we think we know a lot about, right? Okay. Basically, you know, we know if it's hot or cold. Right? But we need something that's quantitative. Just saying one object is hotter than another is not sufficient. We need to quantify what we mean by one thing is hotter than another. So we need to introduce temperature. Of course, there are several temperature scales for measuring temperature. All right, so let's see. Temperature scales. The one you're most familiar with is Fahrenheit. We'll designate with an F. So you're most comfortable with that. You've grown up with it. You see it in the news all the time. So if you, for example, live much further north, like near the Canadian border, you would actually get readings of temperature in both Fahrenheit and Celsius. All right. So Celsius is a metric scale. It used to be called centigrade. Celsius scale is what a lot of the rest of the world is using. When I was young, way back when, they used to say, you know, we're going to get rid of Fahrenheit, we're going to have Celsius. Well, that hasn't happened yet. Okay. We still have Celsius. All right, so here are two temperature scales, and what we'd like to do is relate these scales. And the way you relate scales is you find some common points at which you can measure the temperature. So a typical type point is the point at which water freezes, right? So the freezing point. Freezing point Fahrenheit is what?
32.
Freezing point Celsius.
Zero.
See, I told you. Okay. What's another point that I could look at?
Boiling
point. Okay. What's a boiling point Fahrenheit? 212. Thank you. And for Celsius? 100 degrees. Okay, so there we have it. Now somebody could tell you that the temperature outside is 30 degrees C. Is that hot? Cold? that would be a little bit warm. So the idea is we'd like to be able to convert between these scales. Or maybe you don't like these scales. Maybe you want to invent your own scale. All right, how do we invent a temperature scale?
Okay. We're going to derive the relationship between the two of these using a little bit of math. So I'd like to look at the conversion between these. Okay. So let's see. Let me look at Fahrenheit versus Celsius. I could have looked at Celsius versus Fahrenheit. Either way. And let me designate on both on this graph of temperatures the freezing point and the boiling point. So the freezing point corresponds to 0 Celsius. So 0 is here. And 32 Fahrenheit. Let me say that that's 32 on the Fahrenheit scale. Okay, so a point on my graph at 0, 32 corresponds to freezing. Okay. Then I want to designate the boiling. Let's see, I need to come out 100 on Celsius, and I want to put a dot up here corresponding to the boiling point so that I can read the boiling point. Let's put it up here. What is it? 212. Okay? So there's my boiling point, here's my freezing point, and let me design a scale that is linear. In other words, I want a scale that connects these in a linear way so that any temperature Celsius in here, I can come up and it'll lie on a line that connects the two. So this is a linear temperature scale. And now I can just go along the bottom, go up, go over, and I can tell what the Fahrenheit reading is. So let's say in general, this is C. Go up, go over, and read F. The question is, can I write down the equation of this line and these variables? All right. You've been able to do this in algebra, right? Where this was Y and that's X, and you can write the equation of the line, right? Given 2 points, determine the straight line. Okay, so let's do that. So how do I determine the straight line? Given 2 points. Given 2 points, how would you get the equation of a line? What's the first thing you do? Get the slope, right? And then you can use a point slope form, okay, to determine this. All right, so a little review of some algebra. All right, so I get the slope. The slope of this line is what? Let's see, I could do it from these 2 points. The rise goes from 32 to 212, the run goes from 0 to 100. So my slope is going to be equal to 212 minus 32, the difference in the y's, or the difference in the x's, 100 minus 0, as I keep hearing, 180. Over 100, 180 over 100, I can simplify that. Of course, we could put 1.8, right, but that's not what one normally does. One actually writes this as what? 9 over 5. Divide the top by 20, divide the bottom by 20. Right, we can reduce that to 9/5. So there we have the slope of the line is 9/5. And now, we use the point slope form. Let me write this out in the way you would have seen it in algebra. You have y minus y0 is equal to m
times x minus x0, right? Okay. So I got a line that goes through the point x0, y0, m is your slope, and x and y are your general x and y. So you have the equation that if you plug in an x, you get out a y. In our case, y is f. X is c. And then x0, y0 is, well, we have 2 points to choose from. We could either pick the freezing point or the boiling point, and then we would end up with our equation. So this is going to be f minus, okay, I'm going to use the freezing point. So you can go back and use the boiling point. Convince yourself it works. This is f minus 32 is equal to the slope, which is 9/5 of c minus what?
Zero.
Alright. Zero goes with 32. If you were to use the other point, then this would have been 212 and that would have been 100. Alright. You'll end up with the same equation. Okay, clean this up. F minus 32 is 9/5 C. So F is equal to 9/5 C plus 32. So there I now have a scale. If I want, I can develop a different scale. Maybe I don't like 0 degrees here. Maybe I don't like this to be 100 units going out. Right? I could change what numbers I would have for the freezing point and boiling point. Design my own temperature scale. Of course, there'd be a problem there because it might be hard to sell it to other people. Right? I mean, if you want to design a scale and name it after yourself, you know. So Celsius has become fairly ingrained. What's nice about Celsius is that it is based on 100 units between boiling and freezing points of water. Okay. I don't know. Let's do it real quick. What did I say before? 30 degrees did I use? I have the temperature is 20 degrees C. 30. I'm thinking 30 and I wrote 20. And then, what Fahrenheit temperature does that correspond to? F is equal to 9/5 of 30 plus 32. 5 and the 30 is 6. 6 times 9 is 54. 54 plus 32 is
86.
Okay. Now, there's another formula that you might see in which what I could do here is instead solve for C, then I would just get 5/9 of F minus 32 is C, right? So there's an equivalent. You don't have to know both of these. All right, we could solve that for C by just bringing the 5/9 across from this equation instead, right? You could get that one. You don't need to know both of them. Right? They have the same information. You only need to know one of them. Okay, but whichever one you're comfortable in knowing. And again, to make sure everything's right, just remember where this came from. Right? If I come over here and I put F equals 32, I get 0 out, right? If I put 212 in there, I better get out 100. If I don't, then I got my formula wrong. Alright, so start getting confused about whether it's 5/9 or 9/5, just go back and remember where it came from. Those aren't the only temperature scales that we're going to be using this semester. There's another scale referred to as the Kelvin scale. Okay, and this comes from looking at what's known as a constant volume thermometer. What you do is you put a gas in a particular thermometer, okay, and you can use that to tell temperature. So basically you look at different gases. And it turns out that there's a relationship between the pressure and the temperature. If I lower the temperature, then the pressure is going to go down. Okay, and a constant volume thermometer. So we'll investigate some
of these ideas relating pressure, volume, and temperature a little bit later in the week. And so the idea is that if we lower the temperature, the pressure turns out to go down. And so what I could do is look at the temperature here. I could look at the pressure. And let's say the temperature is in degrees Celsius. And I put a particular gas in and I lower the temperature, and we find out we get a relationship that looks something like this. I would keep lowering and lowering until finally, well, we don't quite get there because it's kind of hard to lower the pressure all the way to zero, but you get to a certain point where you can then extrapolate to where it might go if you actually could get the pressure to zero. And then you look at another gas, okay, and you find something similar. You end up with a different relationship, but turns out that these appear to end up going toward the same point. You look at another gas. So you do this with several gases. Of course, it's hard for us to do that without equipment to do it. Right? Lowering the pressure, lowering the temperature and watching the pressure go down. And you find out that there's a particular point here toward which all these gases go, which indicate that we've got zero pressure there. So it looks like they're headed towards this common pressure. Pressure equals 0 point. And the temperature here is something like minus 273.15 Celsius. So what we could do is look at that point and call that point absolute zero, in the sense that maybe we can define a temperature scale which looks like Celsius, which has about the same size unit, but which starts at zero. So we could introduce a new scale that's zero here, and goes up in an appropriate fashion up the scale. And so that new temperature scale is the Kelvin scale. All right, so the idea is that the temperature Kelvin will be the temperature in Celsius plus 273.5. So that works, right? Just take this at 273.15 to get zero. Okay, so that's the basic idea, okay, for the conversions. So typically, okay, one doesn't put degrees Kelvin, one just puts a K for Kelvin, and leaves it at that. For now, that's all I want to say about the Kelvin scale. Other than, in practice, we're just going to use 273. Right. How often do we have 5 sigmas in this class, right? So 273 could be sufficient. There will be times in the next few days which Kelvin is the only scale you're supposed to use for a particular application. Okay. But we're not quite there yet, so we're not going to worry about it, at least not today. Okay. All right, so now we have a couple of temperature scales. Right? All this was just introduced. Relationship between Celsius and Fahrenheit, Celsius and Kelvin. So now we have some temperature scales. We'd like to go out and start doing some measurements. One property of substances is that when you heat the substance, they tend to expand in general. Not always, but in general they do. Well, let's think about thermal. Example, I have a bar, a metal bar. And that bar is at a particular temperature. Well, let's say that this bar is at some temperature T0 initially. I heat it up, and it expands. Okay, since this is sort of like the rod that we saw the other day, like yesterday, okay, in which we were applying forces, right, through, and getting linear deformations in the same way, this type of a bar, we would only be interested in its expansion in one direction. So we're going to look at linear expansion. Assuming that that bar, when I heat it, changes its length. So let's say this has a particular length. So when I heat it, it's going to be a little bit longer. Somewhat exaggerated. So now it has a new length, L, and a new temperature. And we know that the change in length is basically delta L. So delta L, as usual, is the final minus the initial length. That resulted from a change in temperature, which is given by what? The final temperature minus the initial temperature. By how much does this expand? What is the change in length? Well, we would expect it to be proportional to delta T, possibly. It turns out that, again, this is a fractional change in length. So it really is going to be looking at delta L over L0. That's one way to write it. And so what we do is look at the fractional change in length, and that's going to be careful. It's going to be proportional to the change in the temperature. And the types of things that could depend upon, of course, are the material, right? If this is wood, it would respond a bit differently than if it were copper. Copper responds differently than steel, etc. Concrete, another example of stuff that comes up in problems. So this is proportional to delta T, which means if I keep it equals here, if I throw in a constant. So we're going to throw a constant in and write this more by bringing the L0 over more like this. I'm going to put a L0 delta T, and I'm going to put a constant of proportionality in alpha. And alpha is the thermal coefficient of linear. Again, that could be looked up in a table. So let's look at a simple example. Let's say that I have a copper rod. Of length 60 centimeters. Heat it from, I don't know, 30 C to 500. Pretty hot. So I have to be a little careful here. I may end up getting temperatures that would melt it, right? Okay, let's do that. So I have a copper rod of this particular length. I'm going to heat it between two temperatures. The question is, what is the change in its length? What do I need to do to this problem? I need a constant, right? So, look up the constant. All right, see, chapter 12. thermal expansion. 342 in my book. Table 12.1, copper. We have the linear constant is 17 times 10 to the minus 6. What are the units? Degrees C to the minus 1. Alpha has units. Let's go up here and look at the equation. L0 has units of
meters.
Delta T has units of degrees C. What do I have to have in the end? Degrees. Not degrees, meters. How do I get rid of them? I have to divide out degrees C. So I have to have alpha have units of inverse degrees Celsius in order to have meters come out of the equation. So that's something that's left off in a lot of quizzes. That's the appropriate unit if I ask you to solve for alpha. Okay, let's see how big of an expansion we get here. Okay, delta L is equal to alpha, which is 1/7 times 10 to the minus 6. It's one of those combinations that you see that you might think, well, why don't they write 1.7 times 10 to something? Right. I don't know what they do. Okay. Times what? L0 is 0.6 meters. Don't forget to convert. Delta T. 500 minus 3. And what do we get?
0.004794. So 4.8
times 10 to the what? Negative 3. Do we agree? Anybody agree with this? Looks about right. This is on the order of 5 times 3 times this is 4.
Okay.
So how big is that? That's 4.8 millimeters. Doesn't seem like much, does it? Of course, in machine work, that could be a lot. Okay, and things like that are important, you know, like O-rings and shuttles and things like that, right? All you need is a little gap, and next thing you know, you lose the whole shuttle. Okay, so these things can be important, even though they look small. All right. So that's for thermal expansion that's linear. There's also volume expansion. Area expansion. Okay, typically for volume expansion, you have the account for the other dimensions as well. All right. If your cross section is fairly small, you don't see that much change. You might mostly see that change in the length of the object. But for volume expansion, I've got something with a volume. So when I heat that object up, I would like to know what is the change in the volume. So we look at the change in the volume. It is going to be proportional to the original volume times the change in the temperature. Pretty much takes the same form here, but instead of lengths, I have volume. And there is a thermal coefficient of volume expansion, which people put in a beta. Lowercase b in Greek. And so you can do the same type of arguments here. You just have to deal with volumes. And that's, you know, a little difficult for us to do at times because the only volumes that you're comfortable with typically are rectangular solids. Right? Length times width times height. All right? It gets a little more complicated if, for example, you have the volume of a sphere to compute it. But you can visualize it, right? A sphere will heat up.
Which reminds me, there may be some homework problems for volumes of the sphere. Anybody remember what the volume of the sphere is? Four-thirds pi r cubed. As I recall, there may be some balloon problems and things like that in Archimedes' principle applications, which require the volume of the sphere. All right. Typically, beta is approximately 3 alpha, which kind of makes sense. Dimension one. But one would have to actually derive that to convince you. Okay. All right, so we've seen temperature scales. We have seen thermal expansion. And volume expansion is just a little... basically, I guess you could say it's linear expansion on steroids. But it's just more work to be done in more directions. Okay. The next thing we want to talk about, okay, which maybe I'll take a, I think we have time for a couple minute break before I move on. But the next thing I want to talk about is heat energy. Okay, there are two topics in this chapter: temperature, which we just saw, heat energy. All right, things we're going to use in the next couple of chapters. All right, first part of chapter 12 just is an introduction to temperature. All right, so far we've looked at temperature scales and thermal expansion. Okay, now what I'd like to talk about is heat energy. And so that's the next thing. Okay, very often one just refers to heat. But we're really talking about the heat energy. And heat energy is an energy that flows from hot objects to cold objects. Does. Remember what the units of energy are.
Joules.
Units of energy are joules. That's the same for heat energy. Okay, heat energy can be measured in joules. However, there's also an older unit that comes up quite a bit, one that I grew up on, is the calorie. So calories are another unit of heat energy. And there's a relationship between calories and joules. Okay. And this relationship, or this conversion, actually has a name. It's called the mechanical equivalent of heat. The idea is that people didn't quite relate heat energy, okay, as we know it now, to energy. All right, they thought it was some other thing. A lot of people studied what happened when you heated objects up. All right, so they used to do experiments and decide, you know, we're going to put stuff, phlogiston or something, okay, into an object when you heat it up. And if you put stuff into an object when you heat it up, maybe it changes its mass, but they had a problem because they couldn't detect any mass changes. Okay, but, you know, on one hand they're talking about heat, they're using calories, on the other hand somebody's doing experiments and showing that actually that heat energy can be converted to work energy or whatever.
paper. So you had people like Jules and others which were doing experiments such as shooting cannonballs into buckets of water and seeing them heat up, or rotating paddle wheels and using that mechanical energy to create heat energy and whatnot. So there were all sorts of studies in which they finally came to the realization that heat, the process of heating something, was really just adding energy to it. So we have these two types of units, joules and calories. One calorie is equal to 487 joules. That is the so-called mechanical, that's the mechanical equivalent of heat. Relating these, the basic is so there'll be things I'll be doing in calories, sometimes we'll do some things in joules. Okay, sometimes the book will stay in joules and not in calories, so we have to be ready to do this conversion. There's another type of calorie, which is called a big calorie. Alright, capital C calorie. This is the type of calorie that the everyday type people that don't take physics worry about. Okay, when you worry about diet and things like that. The big calories, the label of calories on your food products and whatnot, actually a kilocalorie. Or basically 1,000 little calories. Okay, so I guess that's not too bad here. Intake, 100 calories or something is better than 100,000. Right? Imagine that. These are all labeled little calories, right? Wow, I just, saved 10 calories. Not much. So, all right, so these are the types of things. So first are the units. As I said, when you heat an object, something is going to happen to that object, and there are a couple of things that can happen. Okay, the most common thing is, if I heat the object, what will happen? It'll get hotter. Yeah, I could explain, but I'm more interested in the simple things, like, you put heat energy into an object, and it could possibly get warmer. The temperature could change. Right? Of course, once the temperature changes, you may be interested in things like what's the thermal expansion like. But before we do that, the question is, how much energy do I need to put into an object to get it to change, say, 10 degrees? Well, that depends on the object, doesn't it? And so you have to consider that different objects are going to use that energy in a different way. It also depends on how much you have. You put a certain amount of heat energy into a little ice cube like this is different than putting the same amount of heat energy into a big block of ice, right? You're going to see a different change in temperature. So it depends on the mass of the substance. Okay. So in order to study it, well, we need a letter for heat energy. So an obvious letter for this would be Q. We use Q for heat energy. Okay. So let's see. The first thing we're going to do is introduce the idea of specific heat capacity. Which we'll actually investigate on Friday in the lab. For a couple of substances. The idea is the following. I have a certain amount of heat energy that I put into a body. That depends on the mass and is related to the change in temperature of the body. So the idea is the heat energy is going to be proportional that a body has. Let's say I have a body undergo, I want it to go through a certain temperature change. How much energy do I need to put into it? Something proportional to, number one, the temperature change, number two, how much stuff I have. Okay? But it also depends on the material. Is the stuff copper? Is it wood? Okay, et cetera. Okay. So you have things like, you know, do I stir a pot with a metal spoon or a wooden spoon? Do I leave my spoon in the pot? Okay. And if you do enough cooking, you know that a metal spoon gets hot pretty quick. So we put a constant of proportionality in here, little c. Little c is the specific heat capacity. And the specific heat capacity we could define in a couple of ways depending upon the units that we have coming out of here. So one way we could define the specific heat capacity is what happens when I put one unit of mass, that one unit of mass changed by 1 degree. Right? How much energy will it produce? Alright, specific heat capacity. So for example, we could have 1 gram of water changes 1 degree Celsius. Alright, so 1 gram of water changes 1 degree Celsius, so this specific heat capacity is for that. How much heat does it take to change 1 gram of water 1 degree? All right, the specific heat capacity in this case would tell me that that amount of heat could generate, say, 1 calorie of heat. Okay, so specific heat capacity is essentially, how much, pick 1 calorie of heat, apply it to 1 gram of water, and it changes 1 degree C. For water, the specific heat capacity is just actually 1. What are the units? What would C have to be to get calories out of that if I put in grams and I put in degrees C? Is 1 what? Well, I need calories to come out. I need to divide out the mass, and I need to divide out the temperature. Okay, so take number 1. We probably should use it to remember that. Okay. Okay, so looking at water as our standard, we can define, essentially, well, we could say, we could define a calorie this way. We could say 1 calorie is the amount of heat needed to raise 1 gram of water 1 degree C, right? And putting C equal to 1 there is a good way to define the calorie. This isn't quite exact. Turns out this 1 degree of C has to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 15 degrees to begin with, right? Changing water at a higher temperature actually could be slightly different, but to be specific. But for the most part, most of the ranges for water that we're interested in, from 0 to 100, C equal to 1 holds pretty well. Okay, so there's a specific heat capacity. That's, then we could go and define some other units. We could look at joules per kilogram, all right, which is more along the lines of the stuff we're doing now. So what if I wanted to convert that quantity into joules per kilogram? How could I write this specific heat capacity that way? All right, let's convert to joules per kilogram degree C. Let's see. C for water. I'll put W on here for water. Make sure. C is not always one, but just value for water. All
right, so CW is 1.0 calories per gram degree C. I want to convert this. I need to convert calories to joules. So I need joules per calorie. And I need to convert grams to kilograms. So just like we did in chapter one, right, here's our conversion. Grams will go out, leaving kilograms downstairs. The calories will go out, leaving joules. So I just have to go in and put in the appropriate numbers for conversion. How many grams are in a kilogram? 1,000. How many joules in a calorie? 4.186. Or if you note, 4.186. 4.6 is probably a lot correct. We usually hold on to all those anyway. All right. That's not too hard to multiply out. We don't need a calculator, right? So that's 4 times 1,000 is about 4,000. So what do I have? Joules per kilogram degree C. So there is another value for water. That's a little harder to remember. Okay, unless you know the mechanical equivalent of heat. Then you just have to decide what it is for 4,000. All right, so there's a quick conversion using the mechanical equivalent of heat. The idea is that given a particular substance, if I know what C is, I can figure out what the temperature change is going to be. You tell me how much heat energy you put in, how much stuff you have, I can tell you by how much the temperature will change if I know specific heat capacity. Or instead of specific heat capacity, we usually just get lazy and say specific heat. All right, so that's one thing that can happen when I heat an object up. Okay, but that's not the only thing that can happen when I pump energy into something. If I have an ice cube at 0 degrees and I pump energy into it, what will it do? It will melt. It will undergo a change of state. And so we have, in that particular case, what's going on? We have an ice cube in which it's a solid. We have all these molecules that are tightly bound together by some kind of bonds. And so what you have to do is you pump that energy in and they start vibrating enough until they break those bonds. Okay, and breaking those bonds, they then are free to begin to flow, like water, right, as a fluid. But while it's at that 0 degree temperature, it's not changing temperature in general, or at least ideally. All right. We assume whenever we're adding heat to something like that, that we're doing it uniformly throughout. Of course, we know a little better than that, right? You throw an ice cube in your drink, not all the ice disappears at the same time, all right? Slowly it does. But we assume that all the energy that we pump into our systems will go first to changing the phase and then to increasing the temperature. Okay, so in this particular case, I want to talk about latent heat. Again, this is something else that could be confusing to people back in the 1600s. All right? The idea that you put in this energy into the system and it changes state. All right? It's not the same type of thing as that you see when you heat an object up to change the temperature. And so they refer to this type of heat energy that's being used as latent. What does latent mean? Anybody have latent talent? Hidden. All right, latent means hidden. So this is like a hidden heat. Okay, so for latent heat, we have a change phase. So we have all sorts of phase changes that we could look at. So for example, I could go from solid to liquid by just adding heat energy. Solid to liquid is what?
Melting.
And then we could go liquid to gas.
Evaporating.
Vaporization.
Vaporization.
Vaporization. Boiling. Of course, we could go the other way. What if I were to go liquid to solid? What's that called?
Freezing.
What if I were to go this direction? Not that. All right. Gas to liquid.
Condensing.
So we can have all sorts of processes here, but what you're doing essentially in going from solid to liquid, you're adding heat energy. Going from liquid to solid, you're taking out heat energy. Okay, so for example, if I were to put some water in the freezer, the whole point of the refrigerator is to pull out heat energy from that so that it does become a solid and get colder afterwards. Okay, so that's latent heat. How much heat energy does it take, okay, to melt a knife, for example? Well, what do you think it might depend upon?
Size of the ice cube.
Right? So the amount of heat energy is actually proportional to the mass of the stuff that's undergoing this transition. And there is a constant, capital L, which is called the latent heat. Okay, latent heat of what? Well, it depends. Okay? In the first process, if I have melting or freezing, okay, this is called the latent heat of fusion. And so we have in the process of melting or freezing, law is fusion. Now we fill in the law. If I have vaporization, boiling, or condensation, then this is called the latent heat of vaporization. Okay, so latent heat of fusion typically may be written in your text with an LF. Latent heat of vaporization, we can write LV. F for fusion, V for vaporization. So when I'm looking at this, Q is equal to ML, this says that it takes a different amount of heat energy for me to go from solid to liquid, right, than it does for me to go from liquid to gas for the same amount of substance. Okay. So typical values, again, for water. Amount of, the latent heat of fusion is approximately 80 calories per gram, whereas the latent heat of vaporization is about 540 calories per gram. Actually, it's more like 79 and 539. Okay. If you want to know what this is in joules, per kilogram. What do I need to do to convert joules to we just did that, right? You want to convert joules, calories per gram to joules per kilogram. You just need to multiply by 4,186, as we did in that problem. So what if I take 80 and multiply it by 4,186? What do you get? 3.35 times 10 to the fifth, or 33.5 times 10 to the fourth. Why do I write it this way? Because you'll see it written this way in your text, okay, or even in your chemistry class.
Okay, take 540, multiply that by 4,186, and what do you get? 22.6 times 10 to the fifth. Thank you. Okay, so you'll see these numbers come up. I like these better because they're simpler. It's easy to convert. Okay. All right, so what I want to do is put these things together. And one problem. Very often in applications of specific heat capacity and looking at the heat energy, and what you have to do is think about what's going on. As heat energy is added to your system or taken away, what's going on with it? First off, is it just changing temperature? If it is, that's an easy problem, relatively. But if it's going through a change phase, then you have to think about how much energy is going to go towards that melting or freezing or boiling or condensation, depending upon where you are, and work from there. So let's look at a typical type of an example. Let's say I have, 200 grams of coffee at 98 degrees, right? My coffee's just come out, it's real hot. Okay, let's assume my coffee's fairly weak, so it behaves like water. Okay, so I have 200 grams at 98 degrees. How much ice at 0 degrees C must be added bring coffee to, make my simple numbers, say 68. Say what?
78.
You want your coffee at 78? That's the idea. Okay, so how much ice at 0 degrees C must be added? So we have to think about what's going on in this particular situation. I have ice, and I've got coffee, I put them together. The ice is going to, number one, melt, and number two, its temperature is going to go up. We're going to assume that these are going to reach that mid-temperature, right? The ice is going to melt so that both the ice has gone up to 68 and coffee has gone down to 68, right? That's some nice equilibrium, okay? So the ice has two things to do. It has to melt, and it has to go up to 68 degrees from zero. All right. Where does it get the energy from to do that? From the coffee. So you have to think about how much energy has the coffee given up, and how much has the ice absorbed. Okay. So you can think about the Q ice and Q coffee. Okay, but I'm just going to think about these in terms of magnitudes, not in terms of signs. Right? The ice is gained, then the positive Q, if the coffee is lost, is negative Q, but I don't want to think about it that way. I just want to say I have so much energy, right, that the coffee is giving up. Some of it's going to go to melting, some of it will be raising the temperature. All right, for the coffee. All the coffee is doing is changing temperature. So this is just going to be the mass of the coffee. Let's make capital M the mass of the coffee times the specific heat of the coffee times the change in the temperature of the coffee. So all of this is coffee. All right. So let's see how much energy we have at our disposal. How much mass? We have 200 grams. Times, well, since it's in grams, I might as well use the specific heat capacity of my water. Again, like I said, I'm going to assume my coffee is like water, which is one. And one of the reasons I like using calories in grams is one is nice to work with. Okay,
Okay, delta T, how much temperature change do we have in the coffee? 98 minus 68 is? What?
30.
Okay, that's the easy side. Go to the other side. What do I have for the ice? The ice has to melt, so we have, I'm going to use a little m for the ice. So the ice has to melt. I'm going to be need energy to melt. How much energy? M times some L. Which L do I use? Okay, fusion. The latent heat of fusion. It takes as much energy to take water and freeze it at zero as it does to go the other way. In principle. So I need M, that's the mass of the ice, times LF, plus, now that the ice has, right, you melt the ice and now you got to bring the ice up from zero up to 68. Now it undergoes a change in temperature, which I've erased right here, Q equals MC delta T. So we come over and the mass of the ice times C for the ice times the change in its temperature. All right, that's the ice side. Okay, the mass, I don't know the mass of the ice. What is LF? Well, in units of grams and calories, it's about 80. So that's 80 M. And then I have, again, I don't know M. C. Right, what does the ice become once it's melted?
Water.
So now it's water, right? So the C is 1. So that's M times 1. What's the change in temperature of the ice? 68. Okay, so now I have my one equation and one unknown. 80 plus 68 is?
138
M. And that's 200 times 30. That's 6,000. Divide out the 148, and we get the mass is 6,000 over 148.
40.5.
40.5, or sorry, I would say 41. What?
Grams.
So we have 41 grams. Now I could modify the problem. I could have had colder ice. What if I had ice at negative 10 degrees? How would that affect things? You have to do MC delta T for the ice. You've got to get that ice from the minus 10 up to the zero. All right? So you have to think about the process. What's going on? How's the, where's the heat energy coming from? And where's it going to? As you're doing this. So this is just using Q equals MC delta T, Q equals ML, putting those together by thinking about how that energy is being moved around. Okay, that's enough for chapter 12. Chapter 13, by the way, is